Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
In September 1972, Bob Barker picked up the microphone for the new Price is Right and started giving members of the studio audience, usually nervous housewives, the chance to win.
Here is the first item up for bids on the Price is Right.
It's happening!
All the contestants had to do was guess the cash value of the prize. The contestant who was closest to the actual cost without going over won the prize and was invited up on stage to guess the prices of more prizes.
Oh, you won a washer and dryer. Isn't that exciting? And now, Betty, things will get even more exciting because you have a chance to win this.
A new car!
Can you stand it? In this case, Betty guessed poorly and went home with $171 instead of that banana yellow Toyota Corolla. That's the way the game was supposed to work. But what would happen if somebody figured out how to beat the game? That's the subject of TV's crowning Moment of Awesome, an article in the current edition of Esquire magazine by Chris Jones. Chris joins me now from Ottawa. Chris, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks for having me.
The moment of awesome described in your article doesn't come until 2008, a full 38 years after The Price is Right hit the airwaves. By that point, Drew Carey was hosting the program. How much else changed in the way The Price is Right worked?
Incredibly little, I guess, would be the answer.
Don't fool around with a good thing.
Exactly. I mean, The Price is Right is one of those games that I think has its appeal based on the fact that it never changes, that if you watched it in 1973 or you watched it in 1993 or now, it's pretty much the same show. There's this comfort of routine in it, I think.
The subject of your article is a fellow named Terry Neese, and it seems safe to say that Terry is a little bit of a character. What is it about him that made him the perfect guy to take on The Price is Right?
There are certain people who have brains that work in particular ways that I think makes them good for cracking games. And Terry started his professional life as a weatherman, and unlike most of today's weathermen, he actually understood weather and was very good at seeing patterns and could see the meaning of wind lift and barometric pressure and what that meant and causes and effects. He just had a brain that could operate on that kind of level. After a successful career as a weatherman, he started a second life in casino surveillance. And I think in some ways that was Terry's perfect job. He just sat there in this windowless room at Circus Circus in Las Vegas, and he learned how people broke games. And he just watched for the same kind of patterns that you would see in the weather. You would look for those in how someone bet at a blackjack table or how someone played their cards. He had a very hard time just watching people do this. He decided he was going to try to learn how to do this. So he became a blackjack card counter, and then ultimately he set his sights on The Price is Right.
So when you talk about patterns and the way people beat games, you're not really literally talking about cheating. And Terry wasn't cheating when he was counting cards, except by the casino's definition, right?
Exactly. Card counting is one of those gray areas. It's not cheating in the sense that you're stealing money out of the slot machine or you're using a weighted set of dice. You're using your intelligence and your mathematical ability to flip the house edge. Blackjack has a very small edge for the house if you play it properly. And by counting cards, that sort of fine margin, you use it to your advantage. And people who card count don't see a problem with it, obviously. They think they're just being smart and prepared. The casinos, however, don't like any game where the edge becomes the customer's edge, and so they frown on card counting. We'll kick you out of their casino.
All right, so Terry and his wife, Linda, set out to beat The Price is Right. How did they prepare?
They watched the show over and over again. They would tape it, and every night they would lie in bed together and watch it. And Terry says that he began to see patterns that he would see in weather or see in a casino. And in particular, he saw that the prizes on The Price is Right repeat. You know, Rice-A-Roni or Campbell's Cream of Mushroom Soup, you see that again and again. The price is always the same. But it also applies to the bigger prizes. And he first noticed it with a barbecue called the Big Green Egg, which he says he saw a couple of times at $11.75, and it just stuck in his head. And he realized, these prizes just repeat. So I'm just going to study all these prizes, memorize all the numbers, and away we go to California.
Terry and Linda aren't the only ones who figured out the Price is Right. A guy named Ted Slauson did it too, 16 years earlier, but he went home with less than $2,000 in prizes, so I guess it took some luck for Terry to even get to the showcase.
That's one of the reasons I like the story so much, is the idea of preparing for something so rigorously, and yet you still have such a small chance of success. You know, when you go to the Price is Right, there's 300 people in the studio. Only a few will get called down a contestant's row, so that's your first hurdle. Then you get up on stage by hopefully getting a correct bid on something. Then you play your pricing game, and then you confront this giant wheel, the big wheel, which is basically luck. And if you get past that, then you get to the showcase, and then, you know, skill comes back into play. But there is this sort of element of luck thrown into the game that can derail you, and that's what happened to Ted Slauson. He played the game perfectly, but just ran out of luck at the wheel. And there's nothing you can do about that.
All right, so each episode of The Price is Right ends with the aforementioned showcase where two contestants bid on prize packages worth tens of thousands of dollars. I'm beginning to get that kind of excitement in my voice. I'm sure you can hear it. Terry got to the showcase, and he bid exactly $23,743, which turned out to be right to the dollar. This had
exactly
never happened
right
before. How did he come up with such an exact bid?
Well, it depends who you ask. If you ask Terry says he knew the three prizes. There was a karaoke machine, a pool table, and a camper. Mm-hmm. He said he'd seen them all before, added them up to roughly $23,000. And then he claims the 743 was just a lucky guess, that 743 was this number based on his wedding date and Linda's birthday and this number that they had used as their PIN and their telephone code and everything like that. And so he, in the heat of the moment, because you don't have much time to bid, he had blurted out $23,743. He actually thought he'd gone over because he misheard the length of the trailer. He'd come up with this rule of thumb that a trailer is about $1,000 a foot, and he had thought it was a 19-foot trailer and it was a 17-foot trailer. So he says he was worried in the moments after that he had overbid, which would mean that he wouldn't win.
Accompanying your Esquire article online is a video clip of Drew Carey, the host of The Price is Right, announcing the showcases. I want to play just a little bit of that now.
Terry, you had the trailer, jukebox, bid $23,743. Actual retail price, $23,743. You got it right on the nose. You went both showcases.
Now, to say Drew Carey doesn't sound particularly excited that this has happened would be something of an understatement. Why is that?
Because the show thought they'd been rolled. So the contestants make their bids for the showcase, and then there's a producer named Kathy Greco who has this sacred book of prize values. And
how American!
It's just delightful, really. And they convene backstage, and Drew, who is a gambler, incidentally, like to play this game where he bet with the crew who had won the showcase. Mm-hmm. So he came back to talk to Kathy, and he said, okay, so who won? And she said, you know, he got it right on the nose. Drew says, has that ever happened before? And she says, no. And how do you think this happened? And the show had been undergoing some changes right around then. They'd let go of a longtime producer named Roger Dopkowitz, and the producers backstage there, as Terry is dancing to the music on the other side of the splouncy curtain, were worried that Roger had fed the numbers as an act of revenge. So the show had decided that they had been cheated and that this was going to be one of the great quiz show scandals, joining 21 and Press Your Luck in sort of this terrible history of shows that have been broken. Now, as it happens, Roger Dopkowitz was totally innocent. Terry had either just gotten very lucky or he had prepared or had been helped by Ted in the audience. But for Drew at that moment, he thought, the show is over. I've just lost my job. We're going to be part of this terrible history of scandal. I'm really mad right now. I don't think the show is going to air anyway. So here, Terry, you can eat on this for a little bit. Funnily enough, when the show finally aired, really the only scandal was that Drew's reaction was so muted, I guess would be the word.
Yeah, that would be the word.
And people were saying Bob Barker, he would have made such a moment out of this, and Terry would have become one of the great contestants in the history of game shows, and here Drew is just raining on his parade. When you know the background, you understand that Drew is just thinking that he's lost his job, his reaction becomes a little more understandable.
Terry was allowed to keep the prizes. Producers soon added more luck to the games. They started using a larger pool of prizes to prevent contestants from memorizing prices. Terry says the show isn't any fun anymore, but do you think the experience has really changed for the average viewer of The Price is Right?
You hit the nail on the head when you use the word average, Bill. The Price is Right is built on sort of casual viewers, but then a very obsessive group of fans who monitor the show the way satellites watch, you know, military installations. They are so finely tuned on any small change in the show, and they get very upset about changes. Something like Plinko, which is this iconic game, if they changed the lettering on the Plinko board, this would be an issue. And Drew Carey represents evil in that he represents change, because Bob Barker was there forever, and now it's Drew, and this is wrong. You've messed with my show. So certain people will watch the show and notice great change. A casual viewer would probably watch and think, oh, that's the same old Price is Right, but it's not. The prizes don't repeat anymore. They've added sort of different luxury prizes. Trips are now very popular on the show because trips are very hard to guess. It's much more of a luck game now than a skill game. And the people who prided themselves on their skill at that game are, of course, upset that it's just guessing now. It's become something baser.
Chris Jones is a writer for Esquire magazine. His article is titled TV's Crowning Moment of Awesome. Chris, thanks very much for speaking with me.
No problem. Thanks for having me, Bill.
My conversation with Chris Jones about his story titled TV's Crowning Moment of Awesome will be featured on this week's program. I'll also be talking with Dave Zirin, whose new book is titled Bad Sports: How Owners Are Ruining the Games We Love. Dave has a story about George Steinbrenner, who passed away on Tuesday, that may incline you toward a more balanced view of the boss. We'll update the progress or lack of same of Lance Armstrong at the Tour de France and elsewhere. We'll also have a story about a very young race car driver who aspires to the NASCAR circuit. We'll catch up with Marion Jones, which would have been impossible while she was still sprinting, not to mention bobbing and weaving to avoid questions about performance-enhancing drugs, but can happen now that she's playing in the WNBA. And, of course, I'll be joined by Charlie Pierce. Perhaps I'll ask him why some people at Michigan State University, home of the country's largest football stadium, think the place needs to be bigger. So join us, and remember, you can always hear the program at onlyagame.org.